I don't know where that ended, but the next big theme, I believe, has got to be not to let American Jewry forget North Africa. I think that I can understand why you're so interested in stressing Eastern European Jewry, and that's perfectly okay. But I think that if you pipe down on the Moroccan and North African theme, you're going to make a big psychological mistake, and you may lose a good deal of ground that was very carefully built up between let's say 1953 and 1955, 1956. On the subject of the importance of getting the Jews out of Morocco. Now, it's quite likely that it's possible to make here a division of labor, I don't know, the JDC's in Morocco, and maybe you can engender through them a good deal of publicity about the real conditions of Jews in Morocco, or find some other way of doing it. But I think that it would be a grave mistake to let American Jewry forget the situation of the Jews in Morocco. Thirdly, I'd like to say this, that somehow or other, and I don't think that this can be sloganized or dramatized, I think this has got simply to be expounded on an intelligent level to intelligent people, that if anybody thinks that with the means that have been put at our disposal in 1957, we were really able to absorb the 100,000 Jews who would have arrived in Israel in 1957, they're crazy. It's not going to be that. It's not going to be that way. And Al just mentioned the inflationary effects that it's having on our economy, the big economic headaches that it's causing the government, the backlog of housing that it will generate. And particularly the backlog in employment possibilities that will have to be created and may take us years before we create, at the present rate of investment that's going on in Israel. All these things have got to be put across. Yeah. mention one point there. There's a grave psychological problem in this country at the moment that may swell into one of the major political issues in the country, and that is the problem of discrimination between the immigrant, in favor of the immigrant that comes in today, and against the immigrant who came in 3 or 4 or 5 years ago and who's still living in a Marbara. A couple of weeks ago we had a riot, almost, in Bnei Brak, where there's a Mabara of Pachonim, I think, where people have been living for about 3 or 4 years. And just on the border of this Mabara, we are today building new houses, proper houses, so-called, but not Pachonim, for new immigrants who are expected in the next few months. And naturally, the residents of the Mabara regard this as being discrimination of the worst kind, and from their point of view, they're absolutely right. Well, even to dispose of Pachonim, we need to build 20,000 housing units in the next 2 years, and even that will not finally dispose of the inferior housing of immigrants who came in 5 and 6 years ago and are still living to this day in wooden huts. You've got the problem of absorbing new immigrants in the kibbutzim, putting up houses there to absorb immigrants who have already arrived in the country. And these are many indications of what will have to be done, not only in 1958, but for many years afterwards, to absorb the 100,000 who came in 1957. One of the big troubles, and I don't know how you get around it, in UJA campaigning is this, that when you make a slogan of $100 million for a special emergency fund, and even though you only end up with 31, and you regard that objectively as being a damn good effort, and you say it is, the public think that they gave 100 million. And the 70 million is, we need it. If we'd have had it, we could have used it. And because we didn't get it, we'll be needing it for the, until we eventually get it.
On the way down from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv one Shabbos afternoon, we picked up three very lovely young girls in the army, in army uniform. And the three of them in the back of the car really represented a cross-section of the new generation of Israel. One of them was tall and dark, and two of them were short and light, one of them redheaded. The three, all of them were born in Israel, all of them were about 18 years, all of them had just begun their service in the army. The father of one was a Yemenite, the father of the second was born in Russia, and the father of the third was born in Germany. The German parents had come here in 1936, the Russian parents had come here about that time, the Yemenite parents had come about 25 years ago. Here you had three generations of people from three separate parts of the earth who had come here for three different reasons, and yet here were their three kids, all looking different still, even though it was the second generation, yet making up one common front. Because they were very clear in explaining that while their parents might not have understood each other, and might still not if their three sets of parents were to meet, still the three girls, all born in the country, understood each other very well and felt completely as though they were one common population, and therefore the country would have one common future as soon as the differences between the parents had been ironed out in the successive generation. It was really a coincidental and impressive demonstration of this kind of belief we have that the generations will merge their differences and that out of this melting pot will come one common population. We talked for about an hour and a half on the way down just ironing out this one problem, and it was an encouraging thing to feel that it's not just theoretical, but it's absolutely practical to say that there will be a melting of the strains of the population into one population which feels itself to be homogeneous, and that's the important thing. Somebody told the story of the little boy who came from Poland recently who hadn't learned how to speak Hebrew and who was always in trouble with his classmates because he didn't understand them. But then when he caught on to what was happening here in Israel, he coined a phrase which describes the whole situation. He said, "Never mind. In Poland, they understood me, but they wouldn't play with me. Here, they don't understand me, but they do play with me. I'd rather have it this way, because here, I think they really do understand me." I went out to Bat Yam, which is outside of Tel Aviv, south of Jaffa, to see a section of about 500 of the asbestos houses, which have mostly Poles living in them. They are not bad. They're a compromise between a permanent dwelling and a tin hut. They've got several good years of life in them. They're clean, because these are brand new. Water is piped inside. The conduits for electricity are even laid in, although there won't be any electricity inside the huts for a couple of months. Sanitary facilities at the moment are outside, but inside of a very few weeks they'll be brought in. The piping is already inside the houses. I must say that the condition of the people was not bad, and that the amount of goods which they had with them was not bad. For instance, in the first three houses into which we went, there were two of them had pianos, three of them had sewing machines, one of them had a refrigerator, one of them had about a dozen oil paintings hanging on the wall, two of them had two bicycles each. In other words, there are some consumer's goods here which obviously have been brought in either for liquidation or, in the event that the people can hold on to them, for greater luxury later on in life. In either case, they represent a substantial asset, and you can't say that the people are empty-handed. The burning question among them, of course, is work. Once they get work, they're satisfied. Without work, they grumble. Their period of adjustment and orientation simply takes longer. There is a difference between the Poles and the Egyptians and all other immigrants, such as Moroccans or Yemenite or Iraqi, on the question of work. The latter group, the North Africans, will go to the labor exchange and take work which is given to them, whether it's afforestation or road work or ditch digging or whatever it might be. The Poles are more particular, and they try to get work in their trade. This means that for long periods of time, they appear to be unemployed and are unemployed. They've got a little something to live on, to hold out on, that's true. But rather than take just any ordinary work, they prefer to wait and see if they can hit in and find something in their own line. This gives the impression that large numbers of them are unemployed. And this also makes for the possibility of bad letters going back to Poland, where they say that there's no work in the country. Constant efforts are made to get them straightened out on this, at least psychologically. But to come back to the question of dwellings, this style of housing, this asbestos proposition, which can be put up in 6 weeks, and which costs about 2,300 or 2,500 pounds a unit, which includes all of the public institutions of a community, such as the schools, the cultural center, the clinic, and even includes the roads. In other words, you take all of the major capital outlays for a community and you amortize them over the cost of each dwelling in the community, you come to a figure of 2,300 or 2,500 pounds per dwelling, which compares with 6,000 pounds for a permanent place. This type of settlement gets the name of shikun zmani, which means a temporary shikun, and they don't use the word mabara for it, nor should they, because it's considerably better than a mabara. This is in distinction to a shikun keva, which means a fixed, permanent type of shikun. Here at Bat Yam, for instance, the length of time they'll probably have to stay in these temporary asbestos houses is no more than a year or a year and a half, because on the spot nearby there are being built 600 permanent houses in a shikun keva, and these people are going to be lucky because they'll be able to get right into them. I just had a conversation this morning with Mr. Ben-Gurion, and it was very wonderful, except that it was followed up by the presence of colic. If he hadn't been there, it would have been very good. I must say the old man looked fine, a little bit abstract. I had the feeling his mind was wandering off on other things, but he came to life when he talked about the question of a large-scale immigration from Russia. Apparently this was the main thing that he was thinking about. Either he put a theoretical question to me, or he was really serious, because he said, what would you do in America if we got 300 or 400,000 Russian Jews in 1 year? I tried to ask him whether he was being serious or being theoretical, and he said no. He had had a talk with the ambassador in Moscow, who had said to him that there was a chance that if anything were to happen, the Russians might say, good, you want free exit of Jews. We will have free exit for a year. All Jews who want to go to Israel from Russia may do so within the period of a year. He referred, by the way, to the fact that this was similar to what had happened in Iraq in 1950-51. Personally, he, Ben-Gurion, didn't think that this condition would prevail, but as a possibility, he thought that if the Jews of Russia were given a period of time in which to leave, hundreds of thousands of them would avail themselves of it. Some estimates he heard went as high as a million. I told him that Suhr in Paris had said that he had heard that it might be a half a million. But the point was that whether it's a half a million or a whole million, it's clear that you're talking about very large numbers. And BG repeated it several times during the conversation, would the Jews of America rise to the occasion? That was the language he used. Would they rise to the occasion? Meant how much money would they produce if Israel were flooded with, take any number you want, 200,000 to 500,000 who might come out whenever the opportunity were given. I tried to duck the question, but then later when Teddy came in and we talked about heights and what kind of stimulation would produce what kind of result, I thought that maybe for a year, if there were huge excitement, and if Ben-Gurion himself came to America, and if American Jews had free access to go to Russia, and if they could watch the boats coming out of Odessa, and if they could see this fantastic stream of hundreds of thousands of people moving, and if we could publicize it properly and get enough steam up, maybe, maybe you could reach a quarter of $1 billion, 250 million, 200 million, some kind of figure which would represent the entire Jewish population of America reestablishing its roots with Russia, from which half of them come. That's the whole psychological problem. And that's going to take the kind of a build-up which can't be done overnight. We've got to get the Jews of America to start thinking in terms of Eastern Europe and nothing but Eastern Europe. Now, I'll report on the rest of the conversation with the old man later, but this was the main point that he was making. As I say, he looked sort of abstract and vague, and he might have been thinking far into the future, or he might have been thinking of the immediate present. I don't know. He didn't give me any exact hints. That's apparently the way his mind is running, and just for the record, let me note down that that's the way my mind has been running, because thinking in terms of what I would say to the Actions Committee on Thursday, I've been thinking for weeks about building up the thesis that we have to develop a historical perspective among the Jews of America. And this historical perspective has to do, obviously, only with Eastern Europe. I'll develop that later because Colic is getting a little impatient now. Let him say hello.
You're talking to the boys. They're going to listen to this.
This little machine can really do all this? It's wonderful. Herb, it's very good seeing you here. I think your conversation with BG was much better than you thought. He's really enthusiastic. He hears from everybody these days what American Jews are doing. He believes in them as much as you do and as much as all of us do.
The other items of Ben-Gurion's conversation beside the Russian business were all very interesting because they revealed certain sidelights about him. First of all, he wanted to know all about the present Supreme Court. Apparently the nature of the decisions they're making impresses him very much. He calls it a revolutionary court. He wanted to know what kind of a man Warren was. Secondly, he wanted to know how Senator Humphrey was speaking about the results of his visit here. And he seemed quite pleased with the press report from the New York Post, wherein Humphrey had said that he couldn't take Nasser's word at face value. It seems there's a little confusion about the way Humphrey did report his visit. At times he seemed to speak favorably about Nasser, other times not. Ben-Gurion had the impression that Humphrey had come away with a bad reaction toward Nasser. Thirdly, he asked about the Reporter magazine. He wanted to know how Askeli felt, and he was looking forward to seeing Askeli's article. Said he told him that the Reporter was the most important liberal journal in America, more so than the Nation or the New Republic, and therefore he was very curious about Askeli's reaction. And fourthly, he kept asking questions all the time about Blessing Rosenwald. What was his reaction? And I had to tell him frankly that Blessing Rosenwald hadn't changed or hadn't said anything to indicate he changed. hadn't offered to do anything publicly, he kept shaking his head and said, well, at least he isn't fighting you as much anymore, is he? In other words, I think I got the impression Ben-Gurion wanted to feel that his visit with Rosenwald had had some effect upon him. I asked him about the mood of the country. He said that was good, and the mood of the people was good. He was a little upset because he had just heard a report at the cabinet meeting the day before from the Minister of Health, who had asked for money to build another insane asylum because lots of the new immigrants were coming in. Lots means relative numbers. Enough cases of insanity were beginning to appear in this large new aliyot to necessitate another institution, and this disturbed him. Aside from that, I couldn't seem to get a rise out of him. And as I said before at the beginning, I had the feeling that his mind was working ahead, probably toward the Russian situation. We've had long talks with Joseph about a large number of subjects. We've talked about the conference next June, 1958. I told the agency executive about it. Their reaction was very favorable. I'm going to have one last meeting with him before we leave in order to finalize responsibility for the thing. This question of responsibility is the plaguing one, of course, and I think it's safer if all I do is dump it in his lap and expect him to create the machinery to carry the thing up. The same thing will apply to the mission. He, by the way, is in favor of our going to Jerusalem first, and I'm definitely not. I want to begin at the Sharon first. And so I think before I leave, we'll just have to issue the orders to tie up the Sharon and follow last year's pattern. He's persuaded me on this matter of not taking the group overland to Eilat, but flying them down and back. And of course then there's the further suggestion that we fly them from Lydda down to Eilat and from Eilat back up to Haifa. This saves us all the ground travel up to Haifa. And since we're in the air anyhow, it doesn't make that much extra difference. And then being up north, we could cover what we wanted up there, plus any immigrant activities in the port. We haven't settled the military part of the program yet. I think maybe the thing to do would be to take the captured Egyptian destroyer out into the harbor and do some gunnery practice or something with it. Although another suggestion was that we try to arrange to have a paratroop drop somewhere. Spent a lot of time talking to a number of people about the Rosenwald Village proposition. Everybody seems to be for it. Eshkol and Joseph and Abe Harmon and Teddy. The point seems to be to pick an agricultural village which would have a permanent place on the map, call it by its equivalent of his Hebrew name, which would be Ya'ar Shoshanim, or the Forest of Roses, Rosenwald, and then put the name Rosenwald in brackets after it, Ya'ar Shoshanim, and in brackets Rosenwald, and do it when the mission is here in the fall, and that was my suggestion, so that he could have the pleasure of watching this being done in the presence of all of his friends and colleagues. Brings up the question of whether he comes on the mission or not, and it might be that this is an inducement to get him to come. I also took up the matter of Warburg's honorary degree. Abe Harmon, who's very close to Professor Mazar, says that he's obstinate on the matter of not issuing degrees indiscriminately, and furthermore, the UJA has never done anything for the university, And furthermore, the only non-academically deserving people who have ever received degrees are two. George Weiss, who was the chairman of the board of the American Friends for about 15 years, and Alan Brumfman, whose family built about half the campus. Now, outside of these two people, the only ones who have ever received honorary degrees are Ben-Gurion and some academically justifiable individuals in the scientific world. Let me interrupt this because the Laskovs came in, and I'll finish giving the rest of those notes about Dov Joseph later. Let me ask Chaim a few questions. First of all, it was good to see him again and to meet his wife. And I started to ask him how things are in the country, and he said that people have a sort of a settled feeling. This is the relaxation of tension, perhaps after Sinai. 6 months later, the people sort of got the tension out of their systems. Then I asked him how things were going down in the Southern Command, whether there were still Fedayeen coming across, and he was describing to me a very interesting process. I'll let him tell you about how they tried to track these people.
One tracker, following the tracks, found that two men were carrying away a cow, and the tracks began to lead off to the Gaza Strip when the tracker decided he'll go midland into the Negev area to some known hiding place, feeling that he might find the two infiltrees and the cow there. When I asked him, why did you decide not to follow the tracks towards the Gaza Strip but move to the hiding place, he said, well, these are two men, and they'll have to divide the stolen things between them. They can't divide a cow, so probably hide during the day, go out and try and steal another cow, and then have to divide it. He tracked them to that hiding place, and two of them were shot, and the cow was recovered.
All right. Now, we're not so much interested in cows as we're interested in knowing whether many of these people, these infiltrators, are coming across. And are they coming just to get cows and pipe and things, or are they coming to get information, or are they coming to harass the population, or what is the reason that they are coming across now?
There are two reasons that bring them in, or rather two objects. One is stealing and in that way harassing the border settlements. The other one is to gain intelligence. Now, the Fadin organization is coming in with less arms, more intent on obtaining information and coming out than they previously used to do, come in and just murder people and leave the area. These are being tracked by trackers at daytime, and when contact is established, they generally get killed. Now, all the infiltrees who come to steal and indirectly harass the border settlements, they mainly operate at night in groups of 4 to 5 using scouts. They have observation from the other side of the border during daytime, see any inventory left in the area. They stalk it at night, grab and move back. We look after this by strengthening the guard of the settlements and having military ambushes and patrols in the area. Unfortunately, when they are located at early hours of the morning, just before crossing the border, we can't chase them to the other side because there's a United Nations force there. In some settlements, people feel a bit tired of this thing, but it may be a changing mood. These settlements will very soon recover, and the work will go on the front end.
You said that you couldn't chase them on the other side because the United Nations troops are there. Don't the United Nations troops do anything to prevent the infiltrators from coming over onto the Israel side?
Well, the infiltrators manage to get very near to their posts, and nobody stops them. They're not allowed to fire at them. At daytime, they have observation posts along the border, but infiltrees don't come in during daytime. They come in at about 9, 10 o'clock in the evening. It's very easy to cross the border. The UN observe them, but there's much they can do about them. They even let us chase them on the other side when we see the infiltrees 10 to 15 meters on the other side of the border.
If it's the purpose of the UN forces to keep peace on both sides, then one part of keeping peace is to prevent the crossing. Have you complained to the UN and asked them to take steps to stop the crossing from the Gaza side?
We did, and we keep on making these complaints that somehow the infiltrees managed to get across, but nothing happens. We couldn't even manage to come to some arrangement where, once we know that some cattle were rustled across the border, that we get them on the next day or so. It just disappears, and we can't get even a positive answer where the stuff is.
I heard about an incident that took place at, I'm not sure if it was Nahal Oz or somewhere, where the son of the mayor of Jerusalem, Gershon Agron, who I think had a business of spraying crops, was riding in a jeep or something and was blown up by a landmine. Do you know anything about that story?
Yes, in the early hours of the morning, he was reconnoitering an area where the aircraft was supposed to spray, and he stepped on a mine about a yard or two from the border. This was a new mine, because on the day before, we patrolled that area and nothing happened. And apparently that mine was laid out during the night. It was not far from a UN post. As a matter of fact, the first people to be on the scene and give first aid were the Finns who were there.
I heard in Jerusalem the other day that they amputated a leg, although they thought the boy was doing well. Nevertheless, apparently they had to amputate in order to save his life. Well, all right. Now, aside from the question of the infiltrators and the stealing of equipment that goes on, you and your colleagues have contact, I'm sure, with the new Olim who are coming into Beersheba, which is where your headquarters is located. Beersheba is growing rapidly, and there are thousands coming down there. What can you tell me about what you have observed yourself as far as the adjustment to life in Israel of the new Olim? How do they feel? What do they do? What do they say? How do the people in Beersheba accept them? Anything you can tell me about the life of the new immigrants coming into your town?
They, mainly two people from two countries of origin came to Beersheba. They, people from Egypt and people from Poland. They had difficulties in settling. The housing was a bit short, but now some housing units, not very large ones, were opened up for them. I believe about 700 housing units, and they settled. The technical personnel and academic people of academic education got settled very quickly. It's the non-skilled who find difficulty in settling, especially because of lack of jobs for all. And I know of plans being just about to begin in Beersheba and Dimona to give them more work. I saw a settlement near Niftachim called Yesha, where Egyptian Jews have settled. Now, they were townspeople, traders and middlemen, that sort of thing. And their first month was very difficult, until the instructors there on the spot somehow managed to convince the intellectual elite in that place of the necessity and the new values of life which this settlement demands, especially that work or menial work is not a thing that disgraces. Now, another strong influence came to these people. It's their kids at the Weizmann School who constantly, when they have a vacation, come home and pray on their parents to stay in Miftachim and make the length work. I visited them last week, and saw great improvements. People were happy. I saw their efficiency in guarding their own place. I saw the kids. I saw the quarters which they were given. The other difficulty in Beersheba, of course, is the heat from Poland. And it'll take some time before they'll be able to work throughout the day without losing their vitality. At the same settlement of Miftachim called Yesha, I met an Egyptian agent for pharmacy products, worked in Egypt, very good income, and he came to Miftachim. He told me that he didn't feel like staying in the place. He thought that he'll stay there for a couple of weeks until he'll hunt for a better job. But then he stayed for a longer time, and when I met him last week, he said, well, I don't know why I really did want to go away from this Yesha, because I feel entirely different man now. I feel better in the morning, and I really intend to stay here. And he's now the intellectual leader of that community.
Now look, you know that there's a serious problem with this migration. It's very large. 100,000 people in a year is a tremendous number of people. Houses and jobs are only the beginning of what you have to find. You have schools, you have health problems, you have 1,001 problems. Therefore, let me ask you frankly, what is the attitude, first your own personal attitude, and secondly the attitude of friends and colleagues of yours, about cutting this thing down, taking fewer people, spreading it over more years? Do you feel, or your friends feel, that the country should go on taking in so many Olim, or you should begin to cut down as a policy?
People I discuss this thing with are mainly army people, and we seem to laugh off any idea of reducing the number of newcomers. We rather feel that whatever we have should be shared out to those that come in. We feel that there is a way where things work, pay, could be shared out to more people, if only for one sole purpose, to bring as many and as quickly as one can. This is army circles and generally people who tend to view the country as a whole, and I take it as their average opinion. It's also my own opinion.
Following the evening with Lasko, which was a very joyful and pleasant experience, although it went too late, we spent the next day down at Eilat. Now, this thing at Eilat has become just absolutely fantastic. The last time I was there was in 1950 or 51. There's practically nothing there, a couple of houses. Now there are something like 3,000 people living there. The oil tanks are being built in a crevice into the hills so that you can hardly see them, and yet they're very much there, very skillfully camouflaged. The Navy has got a concrete pier and a couple of frigates tied up there. The British have left Aqaba, the Jordanian town, across the bay so that there are no more British boats out in that harbor. The bathing has become quite an important part of life. All of the soldiers find their only possible relaxation down at the beach. Everybody swims with a snorkel tube and they pick up coral pieces, and it's quite exciting. The amount of sweat that's been expended to get every single item down there is quite incredible. Everything is flown down or brought down in heavy trucks after a laborious ride through the whole Negev. And yet there has sprung up in the midst of that crater-like desert, which looks like the surface of the moon, this fantastic copper processing plant with huge steel girders and great vats and tremendous buildings with generators. It's just an incredible sight. There's no relationship to reality, almost as though it's a painting, and because you don't see how this modern equipment could ever be brought to this place. But it's there, and they expect to be digging some copper out inside of a year. The whole thing is very, very impressive. You just wonder whether it's economically viable or not. The point of the mayor is that if the Gulf of Aqaba remains open and trade keeps flowing in and out to Asia and Africa, why, then the town can support a population of 30,000 people. That's his position. If that turns out to be the case, it'll be one of the great spots for settling adventurous people, and it could easily become one of the show places in the pioneering sense. It's a very important army point. There's a fortress there opposite an Egyptian point called Ras El Nakab, N-A-K-B, and that's really the defense point of the lowest possible road by which the Egyptians could penetrate into the Negev. The army fortress is an impressive place. Duty down there is tough. The naval unit is not so impressive. Duty is also very tough. The construction workers are a tough-looking bunch of people. They're the guys who are working down there for overtime and putting up all of the heavy labor. But it's quite a place. The airstrip is half sand and half asphalt, and there's a new hotel going up, which would make the second one in town, and you can get cold beer, and it's something. After coming back from Eilat, I spent a long evening with Giora and also interviewing several people for various speaking assignments. Giora didn't want to use the machine, so I have some notes from him down on paper. Then the next day after that, we went up to Haifa, and I saw the arms exhibition, which is a perfectly striking thing, particularly from the point of view of the internal production here in the country. It's incredible what they are capable of producing themselves. They can do everything right up through heavy mortars and heavy bombs. They stop short of artillery pieces. From that point on upward, they don't have anything that is not artillery or tanks or planes. But below that, they really have everything. Machine guns and mortars and an incredible number of small detail paraphernalia. And it's a source of great pride. Abkhushi tells me that 250,000 people have seen it in Haifa, and I know that Perez said that 250,000 people saw it at the first point at which it was set up, a place called Beit Dagon. The conversation with Abkhushi, by the way, was a very interesting one. He said that the human material of this present Aliyah was excellent, that it was the kind of people they always dream about having, and here they were, and he was certain that they would make a very splendid eventual contribution to the country. As a matter of fact, he thinks that the country can take in 150,000 people a year. He made quite a point of comparing the present situation with 1948, 49, and 49, 50, when the country took in as many as 250,000 people in 1 year, and swallowed them and somehow or other found places for them. Of course, he slid easily over the fact that most of those first people went into Arab housing. I didn't want to challenge him on it. That is empty Arab housing of Arabs who had fled. And he admitted, of course, that the housing problem is the most important thing. He even put it in one sentence. He said, look, a shikun, or a dwelling for a person, is more important than a job. Because all of the Polish immigrants have brought something with them so that they can manage to hold out for the first few weeks or maybe even month, and then they get the 15 days unemployment, well, not unemployment, employment in public works, which the Ministry of Labor puts up if they can't find other jobs. So that they're not really going to starve, but the big complaint is always on the housing, and therefore he said that a shikun was more important than a job. But even believing this, as he does, his point is that the country can take in 150,000 people a year. He also made the interesting comment that unemployment figures have not risen, at least in Haifa, namely that the immigrants which the city of Haifa has obtained have been able to find jobs in the economy and the unemployment figures have not gone up. No, he sounded quite optimistic and insisted, as a matter of fact, that he was much more worried about the spiritual integration of these people into the land of Israel and the life of Israel than he was about their material integration. And spiritual integration meant to him learning the language, coming to feel at home, getting over the long experience of having lived as Goyim and among Goyim in Russia for 15 years, and coming home to themselves as Jews in language, in thought, in patterns of life, observance, conduct, and adjustment. All of this, which he meant by the term spiritual integration, he said, worried him more than their material or physical problems, which he thought could be solved. It's an interesting point, and he made it because, again, he was stressing the difference between this kind of immigration, namely European, and the North African immigration, where you were dealing with masses of people for whom you had to supply basic things like food and shelter, but who were not educated and whose further integration you couldn't hasten by worrying about it. They have to come to their eventual, the North Africans have to come to their own eventual integration through the process of time. These Europeans can be speeded along very much more quickly and conversely may become disillusioned and disappointed much more quickly. So that it's a much deeper and serious problem with them than it is with the immigration of last year. Well, that was about the substance of the conversation with Abu Hushi, which I have fleshed out because I'm summing up all these observances about the difference between the Poles, Hungarians, and Russians, and the previous North Africans and Iraqis. It's a startling difference. It's something which everyone who deals with the 1957 Aliyah must take into account.
Batteries start spinning. Now you can see the spinning.
Yeah.
See? For instance, if you look, you can look at this through the window. Now the point is this, let's get the light on here so that you can see where you're at. If you could see, well, first of all, that it's moving.
Yeah.
And secondly, you can see, if you look in here, that it's about at this point where that tape is. Do you see it?
Yeah.
Look at it carefully and see if you'll be sure to see it.
Yeah.
She's at this point now. So that means that about 10 minutes, means you've got 15, 20 more minutes left.
Yeah.
She winds up down on this end, right? Means she will spin all the way from this side of the spool all the way to this side of the spool. When it all comes onto this side of the spool, it will stop. It's got no more to unwind. That's how you'll know your half hour is up.
Yeah.
So when you're recording, you can keep an eye, not on the dots, that's hard to see.
Yeah.
Keep an eye to see if the thing is spinning.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Now, let's see. That's all.